This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Avocados from South America, apples from New Zealand instead of the next valley, industrially grown carrots with no taste, no vitamins, but a microscopic coating of carcinogenic pesticides. Meanwhile, we're paving over the nearby farms, leaving our cities utterly dependent on global corporations, on cruelty to workers and animals, on oil and daily long-distance trucking and airplanes. If something breaks down or just runs down into collapse, your city can go into starvation in a single week. And the great food system keeps heating the planet, threatening all agriculture. Against all that is a rising tide of support for local food producers. It is a food revolution, and I don't use that word lightly. You will hear two voices of sanity and, yes, of hope. And I hardly ever use that word. The local food movement started with a book, The 100-Mile Diet, by Alyssa Smith and James McKinnon. In Vancouver, Canada, this couple went a year eating only locally produced food. It wasn't easy then. It is a little easier now in many North American cities, as the idea of sustainable cities catches on. 5 years beyond the success of their first book, Smith and McKinnon give us a rapid-fire tour of great ideas, the 10 best local food projects in the United States and Canada. You'll be surprised as local food networks spring up in Toronto, New York, Michigan, and Los Angeles. This talk was recorded by Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock at the Museum of Vancouver in Canada on November 25th, 2010. The museum was one of the sponsors, along with the Taiyi Magazine and the Tides Foundation. We'll tune in just after the introduction by David Beers, the editor of the Taiyi, and a local food activist at the beginning of this localization of food.
I want to start, I guess, by going back about 3 years to when the 100-Mile Diet was published. One of the first things we discovered after the book came out was that if you write a book about food, suddenly everybody wants to share their food with you. That's one of the great benefits of food writing. And so all of a sudden we were getting these invitations. We'd spent this year, trying to get all of our food as close to our house as possible. And all of a sudden we were being asked to go all over the continent, basically to sit down and eat dinner with people. It was kind of the 10,000-mile diet all of a sudden. And we literally were invited from the Yukon to Miami and from New Brunswick to San Francisco and all kinds of points in between. And it's been, really a wonderful adventure, and we've eaten a lot of really good food. One of my favorite meals, actually, was here in B.C. in the town of Smithers in northern B.C. And the reason that one's so memorable is that after the book came out, reporters were often coming to us and saying, well, of course you can eat locally in a place like Vancouver, but this would never be possible somewhere like northern British Columbia. And then we got this invitation to a local meal in Smithers, 100% local meal. And it was a 12-course meal. So after that, the reporters would come and say, well, you could never do this in northern British Columbia. And we'd be able to say, well, yeah, you just have to survive on those 12-course dinners. One thing we really noticed, though, as we traveled to all these places was that if you went from place to place and you bought your food at the supermarket, then you'd pretty much get the same thing wherever you went. It didn't change that much from Miami to the Yukon if you go to the Safeway. But if you went from place to place and you went to the farmer's market, then there could be a huge difference in what people were eating, even within, 50 kilometers or 100 kilometers. So what we wanted to share today is not really a point-by-point comparison of Vancouver, how it's worse or better than this place or that place, but as Dave was saying, sort of 10 projects and places that we think point to some of the new directions that local eating might be going, because the local food movement is really, it's really brand new. It's just out of its diapers. If you think about organic food, organics have now changed the way people eat in North America across the board, but that didn't happen for about, 20 or 25 years after organics hit the mainstream. So local food's taking off right now, but there's a lot of opportunities to take it to a deeper place. And just to give you an example of the kinds of things that that we get excited about, I'm actually going to start right here in Vancouver. So last year, we got all of our vegetables from spring through fall from one farmer. That's Ward Toulon, who some of you might know. He might even be here. I don't know. And you might know him better by his kind of nom de jardin, I guess, which is City Farm Boy. Yeah, City Farm Boy, in case you aren't familiar with it, is Ward is a farmer in the city. His farm is 15 different backyards and rooftops in East Vancouver. So, you know, he's a real urban farmer. And I think the City Farm Boy project is like that all the way through. I mean, Ward isn't just producing units of food in the city. He's changing the way we think about the city, how we see how we can use space in the city. He's even really, I think, he's creating a new way of life in the city. I mean, once you see a city farm boy in action, you start to ask yourself, well, you know, why don't we have a city orchard girl who harvests all the unused fruit in people's backyards, or a city bee boy who keeps hives on the top of 20 different apartment buildings and supplies a whole neighborhood with honey. So these are the sorts of projects that we're talking about. You know, small projects can contain really big ideas. I mean, that's sort of what the 100 Mile Diet was to begin with. But I guess we're not only going to be talking about small projects, because I think Elise is going to take us over to Ontario now. And I think sort of the subtitle of this is like Ontario's way better than Vancouver, nya, 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 something, something like that, right?
Yeah, Ontario is actually leading the way in a few local food fronts, which is quite amazing, because 5 years ago when we first went out there talking about local food and the 100 Mile Diet, Ontario was basically remedial when it came to local food. But they went much further than that. At least 8 cities in Ontario have set very strict distance limits on how far the produce can come, 100 kilometers or less. Vancouver doesn't have any rules like that. The reason that they did it in Ontario is because they wanted to make sure that each of these regions where the farmers markets were, that the farmers weren't having to compete with other areas that already specialized in a product. They wanted to develop a really diverse agricultural base in each community, and that's a really good idea. And then another thing they did was at City Hall, putting their money where their budget dollars should be on local food, they actually decided, okay, we're going to set guaranteed percentages of how much local food that we're going to buy. Any service to do with City Hall, which would include daycares, seniors' homes, and shelters. In Ontario, or Toronto, sorry, that's a really big budget, about $11 million. So just since 2008, they've built up to 20% guaranteed of that budget going to local food. So that's about $2 million. That's a lot of cucumbers you'd be moving at a farmer's market to match that $2 million. So institutional buyers are very important. Right now, Vancouver has no set budget for its city services to be local food. And in Toronto, actually, their goal is 50%. Of course, that's still a bit of a dream, but it's a dream that's not just floating up there in the sky. They've actually hired a consultant to report back to City Hall by next year and tell them, you know, how much will it actually cost to do this 50% guaranteed local food, and then council will vote on it. It might not cost very much, actually, because in Toronto they did a small pilot project where they thought, okay, well, if we just increased the budget in our daycare services by 0.7%, less than 1%, but they managed to increase the local food from 20% to 33%. So just by spending $15,000 more, they got 13% more local food. So that's like a really exponential growth of their dollars when they spend it on local food like that. Other cities in Ontario are going even beyond just local. The city of Markham has decided to do both local and sustainable food. So what they did, about 3 or 4 years ago, they thought, well, you know, we can't start big right away. But for the first year of all the city services to be spent on food, 10% of the budget, increased by 5% each year. So now they're at 25%. And the city of Hamilton is looking to start that same program. And when it comes to the campuses as well, the big university in Toronto, University of Toronto, their main campus has reached 20% guaranteed of their budget to local food. And at the U of T, that's $350,000, again, guaranteed to local growers. I'll be nice to Vancouver for a minute. I think it's very cool that in the last 2 years, we've allowed in the urban beehives and the backyard chickens. That's a huge thing in making urban land productive, making it farmland. Toronto hasn't quite met us on that front. Thank goodness there's something they're worse at. They do allow beehives, but they have to be at least 30 meters from a property line. So for most people living in the heart of the city, you know, they don't have yards that big. They can't do it. But there is a beehive cooperative. They run hives out of the Dan Valley parklands and on rooftops downtown. So there is honey being made in the city. Chickens, though, still prohibited in Toronto. I was reading the list of prohibited animals. So chickens are on there with bears, gorillas, hyenas, and cotamundi, which I didn't even know what it was, but not allowed. So
that was Alyssa Smith on Radio EcoShock. Now we go to James McKinnon, the other author of The 100 Mile Diet.
So I want to take you to another unexpected leader in local food, and this time I'm going to be talking about winter farming. The big guru of winter farming, he's been out here a couple of times, is a guy named Elliot Coleman, and he has a farm on the coast of Maine. So he gets serious winter weather, you know, pretty similar to Nova Scotia or Vancouver in late November. And one of Elliot's favorite sayings is that if you think that organic farming can't feed the world, then you haven't been paying attention. He gets away with saying things like that authoritatively because he produces $140,000 worth of food in a year off of a farm that's 1.5 acres in size. And he can do that in part because 40% of his production happens between October and May, so in the cold weather months. And this is not, we're not talking about greenhouses here. We're not, this isn't one of these situations where you get to eat a local tomato in January because 4 tons of coal have been burned to heat up a greenhouse. He uses just hoop houses. They're not heated at all. They're just, in fact, they're mobile, so he can move them from place to place. And I've had the good fortune to talk to Elliot a couple of times, and I asked him at one point why he thought winter farming hasn't taken off the way that it might. Maybe not surprisingly, he said it's because winter is really cold. Because of that, he always thought that the place that it would take off in first would be the Pacific Northwest and places like Vancouver, and that hasn't really been the case. The leader in cold weather farming, kind of the hot spot for cold weather farming, is Michigan, of all places. So we're talking about places like Ann Arbor and Detroit and Flint, which you might remember from the movie Roger and Me. These are places with serious winter. I mean, snow on the ground for 4 months of the year and temperatures that dip down to around minus 20 pretty often. So I had a chance to talk to a guy named John Birnbaum, who's he's a University of Michigan professor, and he's sort of the guy who's spearheading winter farming in Michigan. And he said there's a few reasons that it's working so well there. One is just the sheer desperation of Michigan. I mean, there's all these factory towns that are collapsing, and they're really just looking for anything that they can use to build up their economy. So that's part of it. And as a part of that, they've managed to get federal funding, so the government is actually buying hoop houses for farmers. But he said the main reason, the main challenge when it comes to winter farming isn't anything technical, it's cultural. He says that people just plain don't believe that you can eat locally in the winter. And that includes farmers. He takes people on hoop house tours, you know, through the hoop houses on the campus farm. And he shows people, you know, all these beautiful green, luscious plants growing in the middle of winter. And he says people just plain don't believe him. He actually catches people sneaking away from the tour to go try and find where he's hiding the heater. They really just don't believe it. So, you know, his feeling is that the most important thing when it comes to things like winter farming or other, you know, really innovative new farming practices is to have incubator farms like the one, that's his term, incubator farms, like the one they have on that campus, which their campus farm produces food 48 weeks of the year and makes about 30% of its income in the winter months. And it has an 18-month waiting list for its organic box program. So it's a pretty big deal. A hoop house. It's basically a metal frame with a double-walled plastic covering, and it protects the plants from double-walled plastic, just keeps the wind and the cold off the plants. And he figures these incubator farms are the key, and that sort of every town and city of any size should have a teaching farm, an incubator farm.
So because we've been spending the last few months in the Hudson Valley, I thought I'd talk about the amazing expansion of farmers markets in nearby New York City. But New York, 5 years ago, when we went out there to talk to publishers about the 100 Mile Diet, we actually had people in New York City say to us, you know, this whole local eating thing, impossible in New York. I mean, look around you, it's the concrete jungle. But since that time, it's totally changed. It would be very easy to eat within 100 miles of New York City today. So I'll do a comparison of our farmers market situation. Manhattan, although when you think of New York, you go, well, that's one of the world's biggest cities. So, of course, they have lots of farmers markets. But I'm just going to look at the urban core, Manhattan. That's just 1.6 million people. So that's the farmers market numbers I'm dealing with. Comparing to Vancouver, which our urban core is 600,000 people. In Manhattan, they've doubled the number of farmers markets since 2002. They have 27 different locations, up to 4 days a week. So in total, that gives you sort of 39 market shopping opportunities a week throughout the city. So that means there's one farmers market per 41,000 people. In Vancouver, we have 4 markets, 1 day a week each, and that means there's one market per 150,000 people. In Manhattan, you can get to them walking distance in all neighborhoods. Just last Saturday, we went to 3 different ones, although we took subways between them because we wanted to kind of do the whole city. This one here is up as far north as you can go in Manhattan and not be in the river. 207th Street, a lot of the Dominicans live up in that neighborhood. And then we went to Midtown, Lincoln Plaza. And then the big one, Union Square, that one's the one that runs 4 days a week, even in the winter. That is an amazing market. And that's the one we went to 5 years ago when we were talking to publishers and said, you can't eat locally. We found things like these maps, and New York is one of the few places I've still seen that has these. Every single stall has a map saying, you know, where the farm is, just general little story about the farm, which is quite nice. Here's a close-up. So you can see exactly how far the farm is from New York City. That's very handy for shoppers because you don't have to keep asking questions. And we also found out that even though New York is such a large city, the median distance that the farmers are coming from is just 90 miles. And of course, it's New York, so even the pet luxuries are local. And there's two really cool things that the Farmers Market Society there has been doing. Because there's also a wheat revival in the American Northeast, just like there has been in BC the last few years. People seem really outraged when they find out that sort of the staff of life, that you can't get it grown where you live, so people really move on that. But what they've done in New York, the Green Market Society itself has been funding building mills so they can mill the flour locally more easily. And just this last year, they put in a rule that every baker selling at a farmer's market in New York City has to use at least 15% local flour in the bread. So that's a really great idea because they can create a market for this new industry, and as more flour gets produced, you know, hopefully it will become cheaper and the percentages will increase even more. And the other cool thing that they're doing is called the New Farmer Development Project. They focus on immigrant groups, mostly Spanish-speaking in New York, and they've been training them through Cornell University, 130 people since the year 2000. So they train them in farming techniques and business practices, but they also recognize that a lot of these countries, like the Dominican Republic, Mexico, they have their own small farmer traditions with a lot of knowledge that they can bring to the table as well. So when they're finished their training programs, they can start selling within their ethnic communities, and these are often in lower-income New York neighborhoods where they don't even have proper grocery stores. So that's a really important service. And they're also integrating into all the other community markets that already exist. There's one called Three Sisters, a Latino farm that we buy from in the little town near us called New Paltz.
So I want to start this next section with a personal story. A couple of years ago, friends of ours in Penticton invited us to raid a walnut tree that was on corporate land there in Penticton. And the tree was totally neglected, but we didn't really know what the laws were around raiding corporate nuts. So we ended up actually dressing all in black and going out at night with hockey sticks to knock the nuts down. You can picture the scene as sort of a low-budget Canadian horror film sort of thing. But we ended up with enough walnuts to supply, you know, several households for a year. And that might be why I really like this little group in L.A. called they're called Fallen Fruit. And they believe that we really should be looking at how to have more free food in the city. And, you know, fruit is the one that they focus on because it's kind of already out there. And Fallen Fruit's a bit of an unusual group for a local food group. It's founded by artists. It's still run by artists. And a lot of their projects have the feeling of art projects. So one of the things they did was sweep through different neighborhoods and pick all the fruit that was publicly available. And then they infused it in vodka. And the end result was that you had this ability to actually taste the difference in livability between different neighborhoods. So, you know, if you went through a neighbor, if it was a neighborhood that had all kinds of green space and public space, then it was going to be this delicious, rich, fruity vodka. And if it was one of these concrete and freeways type neighborhoods, then it's just a shot of straight rock gut. So it's, you know, it has this sort of immediate, different way of looking at the city. Another thing they do is there's a number of groups that in different cities that pick fruit and give it to, you know, the needy in one way or another. What they do is they give fruit trees to away in different neighborhoods. And they do this with on an agreement. They give the tree, and the person who gets the tree agrees to plant it in such a way that some of the limbs will reach out over public land. Because in California, that's the rule. As soon as a limb reaches over public, crosses the private, you know, public-private boundary, you can pick that fruit. So, and they're doing this in a big way. One day they gave out 450 trees, you know, just one day. So that's enough to, that's at a scale that you can really start to see a change in the urban landscape. But the thing they're sort of best known for are maps. And they go out and they map the fruit resources in different neighborhoods. So this is a map of Larchmont, which is a neighborhood in L.A. It's a pretty well-to-do neighborhood and has a fair bit of fruit that you can reach from the street. And it's to be envied. You can't really see it here, but it's persimmons and passion fruit and lemons and limes and avocados and bananas. And, you know, L.A. has a lot of people, as you know, who are genuinely hungry people. So one thing Fallen Fruit does is it leads foraging tours through neighborhoods like this one so that people can access the free food. Maps. This is Malmo in Sweden. This is interesting. You can see there's just an incredible abundance of fruit available. And it's because Sweden, you know, Scandinavian countries have a very long tradition of fruit picking and wild berry foraging. And it's ended up kind of building itself into the cities themselves. And one thing I find interesting about this map is that it includes a lot of wild plants. So there's rose hips and wild apples and elderberry and things like this that in some places wouldn't even be recognized as food at all, but they make it onto the Malmo map. And that this is a neighborhood in Madrid, and you can see what happens when you have almost no public space. There's really no trees at all except in the plaza, which is the only publicly owned space in that neighborhood, and there's a good concentration of fruit there. So with these maps, Fallen Fruit helps people see, you know, how different models of living in the city offer different elements of livability when it comes to things like fruit. And when I first bumped into Fallen Fruit, I mean, they talk about fruit and access to fruit in cities as a basic human right. And I thought that seemed a bit crazy, but then through these maps, you see just how easy it is to make that possible and make it accessible, and then it becomes a pretty exciting idea.
That is part one of a talk by Alyssa Smith and James McKinnon, authors of The 100 Mile Diet. We are hearing their top 10 food localization projects 5 years after the start of the movement. Is your city able to feed itself at all? Do you want to know who grew your food? Stay tuned for part two as Alyssa and James continue this underreported story of growing sanity.